Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Synth 71 podcast. My name's Stuart, the founder of the website, and today I've got a little special episode where we're not talking about any kind of current or active football matches or football teams that have been playing. I'm joined by Louise Kunzler. Did I pronounce that right, Louise?
You did, Kunzler. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
Excellent. It's not a bad start. Louise is an author of a book titled Our Beautiful Game, and we'll go into that over the course of the episode, and hopefully you'll enjoy it and go out and buy it and read it yourself, because it's a really interesting and fun book, one that I've been enjoying reading. How are you doing, Lou?
Yeah, I'm doing really, really well, Stuart. Thank you so much for inviting me on to Synth 71. It's a great honour to come here. It's such a well-named podcast. We know exactly what we're thinking about right from the start, women's football and 71 and the changes. And that's sort of at the heart of my book. So I'm absolutely delighted to kick off. Ha ha.
Hey, I'm delighted that you actually realise what the name actually means. Quite often we might have people that look at it and they think they're not too sure what it's about. So when someone actually gets it, it's quite pleasing for us, because a lot of thought went into that. And we're quite proud of the name, to be honest. So just getting straight into it then, before we talk about you as a writer, I'm keen to explore your relationship with The Beautiful Game. Pardon the book reference.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the southwest, so I've been a lifelong supporter of Exeter City, which is not always the easiest job in the world, but because it's a funny old thing down in the southwest. There's not a massive amount of football, but
I nearly presumed that you were a Plymouth fan, so I'm glad that I didn't do that.
I couldn't possibly be a Plymouth fan. If I was a Plymouth fan, I wouldn't be allowed home. The one thing that, as a Devonian, you have to choose. It has to be Exeter or Plymouth, and I'm an Exeter girl through and through. So it's never the easiest ride, but it's always fun supporting your local team, whoever they are, isn't it? And my husband is actually he's Swiss, so we've had some fun recently with the Euros. Obviously, Switzerland doing so well at the last minute, that was exciting, and then obviously England, and yeah, football's very much part of this house, definitely, because my hubby's always got the football on, and I have two girls who grew up playing a little bit of football. My oldest in particular got really into sports. She got more into swimming, but I think that was one of the things that made me realise how important kind of role models for girls in sport are. So although she didn't continue with the football so much, it was seeing her in a squad as a girl in a squad, a swimming squad going forward. And that really, when I was coming back to thinking about writing this book and thinking about girls' sport, I was really remembering her as a 9, 10, 11-year-old, and just how important it is to feel validated in whatever sport you're taking part in.
Yeah, you're right. It's absolutely huge. Regular listeners will know that I coach an under-15s side at Havant-Moore to Louisville. And I've been absolutely blown away by the level of participation with girls football in Hampshire. Our age group has more teams in it than any boys league in Hampshire at any age group.
Yeah, I think
that's fantastic,
isn't it? And it's been an incredible thing. And it's taken a while, to get to the point where girls feel that football is for them. And I think that's been really important, and something that's just been blown out of the water in the last decade. And it's so fabulous to see. And that, and again, that's one of the reasons why I thought this book that really looks back at the roots of the game for girls and young women was really, it just seemed the perfect time, regardless of sort of centenaries and things that I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. But it just seems that women's football is just so exciting right now, especially at grassroots level, especially girls getting out there and playing and feeling no one can stop them doing it. It really just feels that's the vibe at the minute, isn't it?
Definitely. Inclusion, I'd say, is probably the big word. It's, they feel included, it's and respected. Even though there are many instances where they're still not given the level of respect, but we could talk about that for hours. Things like female fit kits.
We're not going to talk about that. Today's a positive day.
Yeah, exactly. So you've been quite open with your dyslexia. So I wondered how it's affected you in your life, especially as an author, and how you've overcame it to become an author.
I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think... I'm incredibly dyslexic. I was actually as well. I was born left-handed, but changed to right-handed. This was going to school in the 70s when that wasn't happening. I mean, that was happening in the sort of 40s and 50s, but by the 70s, I must have been the last child in Britain to be changed around. So it means that everything sort of in my brain and physically as well. I mean, I'm not a particularly sporting person myself. I kind of struggle with that sort of hand-eye coordination, all that sort of stuff. And I definitely struggle with, getting words down on paper. So it's perhaps odd that for someone so dyslexic that I wanted to be a writer, but I think it's because stories are always spinning in my head. And that's what I would say to anyone who is dyslexic or has dyslexic kids. You know, your imagination has got nothing to do with dyslexia. In fact, people who are dyslexic or who have other, learning needs and differences often make great writers because we see the world in a slightly different way to other people. And so we're noticing that thing that someone else might not notice. And that's what people love to read about, is a slightly different slant on the world. And I've always, been telling stories out loud, since I was a very, very little girl. I mean, I grew up on a windy sheep farm on Dartmoor, and there often weren't other kids around, and I would talk to the sheep and tell them stories. And so verbalizing, and then eventually learning to put that down on paper. But it's like being into sport or whatever. If you want to be better at football, you're going to have to practice every day, every week, and it's not about playing big matches, is it? It's about putting in the skills, doing the drills. It's exactly the same for a writer. Write little bits down to try and capture little character scenes or snippets of dialogue. Don't sit down and try and write a book on the first day in the same way as you're not going to play in Wembley the first time you put your boots on. It's just building it up, making your imagination muscle stronger, because it is like a muscle, and the more you use it, the stronger it gets. So I think that's sort of what's driven me. But yeah, it's not easy being dyslexic and my trade being using words and getting them on paper. But it makes it all the more exciting. I think it's more of a challenge. It's a way of coming at it, I think.
Definitely. We touched on something before we started recording about me personally. I found it easier to read books when I had something visual to link it to. I gave the example of Great Gatsby, where I would have enjoyed the book originally, but I would have enjoyed the story, and I probably would have struggled to picture it and really immerse myself in the world. But after seeing the Baz Luhrmann film, I could read it and picture Leonardo DiCaprio in the role. And while a book purist might say, well, that's a fantasized version of the story, it's not how it was in the real times, that doesn't matter for me. That doesn't detract from it. And then we have Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, those type of books. I would struggle trying to read those prior to watching them on the TV show, because there's so much description and so many different characters and so many unusual words and names that I would struggle with that having it on paper. So yeah, I'm very much a visual person. So it's something that does make it easier for me, especially. And something that you also touched on before we came on about the children's books that you write and about how important it is at a young age to fuel children's imagination through images and visuals.
Yeah, I mean, I write across the age for children. I write for the very youngest kids with picture books, as they're called, you know, the highly illustrated sort of things like the Gruffalo that you might be familiar with, Julia Donaldson, that sort of picture book, right through to books like Our Beautiful Game, which is what they call middle grade, which is for really 8 to 12 year olds. But I would imagine Our Beautiful Game would be really enjoyed by sort of 9, 10, 11 year old readers. That's who I was really imagining when I was writing it. And yeah, I think kids now are great at sort of using their visual imaginations and bring it back to the story, because I think they've grown up with very beautiful, highly illustrated books, which help them as they move into storybooks that don't have pictures, and then they move away. But again, you know, I think it's practice. I think, you know, the more kids read, the better they get at building their own pictures in their imagination. But you know what we're going to have to do, Stuart, aren't we? We're just going to have to make sure that there's a film of Our Beautiful Game, so that, you know,
everyone can
enjoy that alongside the book.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I would certainly be supporting and campaigning for it to be made, because I think it'd be great. I think it'd certainly be enjoyable. Your website obviously describes you as a children's author, so, and you touched on that you think that the book is suitable for sort of, would you say about sort of like 10, 11 year olds?
Yeah, 9, 10, 11. I'd say just on the cusp of leaving primary school. I always write for kind of primary school children more than secondary school children, because again, I just think it's a golden age of children's reading, and, you know, just starting secondary school, you know, so that 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, because then I think it's just a really rich time for kids' imagination, because they're imagining doing stuff on their own without their parents. They imagine their own adventures, but they're still very open, and the sort of pressures of adolescence haven't, you know, necessarily sort of got in the way of that willingness to go on an adventure in their minds and to imagine anything. And I think often if you think of books that you know, kids really have loved as children, whether it's the Harry Potter books or the Narnia books or the Philip Pullman books, or, you know, they're often that golden age of sort of 9, 10, 11, and it's just a glorious age to write for. And I love, one of my favourite things, a great perk of being a children's writer, is that I get to go into schools and go to festivals and do visits with kids that age. And honestly, the questions they ask and the enthusiasm, it's always inspiring. And I always, always come back having learned far more from them than they've learned from me. 100%.
Definitely. I can imagine they put you on the spot.
And I'm sure, you know, it's a similar age probably to the age of the kids that you're coaching. You know, it's just full of anything is possible. And it's a great leaping off point, whether that's through imagination and reading or through sport, you know, to just to find joy in life and to explore that. And that will then ricochet through all other areas of your life. You know, if you're enjoying yourself on the football pitch, if you're reading a great book, hopefully doing both, you know, these are all things that will come back and make you a happier, healthier, stronger person to face the pressures of modern life, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I always feel that everyone should have some sort of passion and interest and if you can put in both of them, then it'll be fantastic.
Yeah.
How did you feel when your first book went into print?
Oh gosh, yeah, it was other than the birth of my kids, and I better say my wedding day. It was definitely, it's a beautiful thing, you know, and it's because it's a team thing as well. Writing a book, and you write a book, and it's quite a lonely thing. You sit in my case, I sit at my laptop, and I, you know, tap 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 away, and you've no idea what you're doing and where it's going, and then finally when that is validated and a publishing company get behind you, and you work with an editor who makes it a much better story, and then you work with the designers who put a wonderful cover on it, and you work with publicity, you make sure that it gets out in the world, and it's an incredible thing and an incredible feeling that sort of secret, private, slightly lonely thing that you did for ages. And again, I've been writing since I was, you know, since I could scribble stuff down with my appalling spelling and my backward letters and all the rest of it. But, you know, I've been writing my whole life, and I've only been published for, oh gosh, 10, 12 years, I suppose. And I'm now in my 50s. So it was a great kind of, you know, middle-aged discovery to have that happen, and to go into bookshops, and I freely admit I will go into bookshops and have a good stroke of my covers if I see them in there. You feel incredibly proud, But again, actually, the highlight for me is then going into schools with, as a published author, and talking to kids and seeing the excitement for them of meeting someone who has done something they may want to do. Kids who want to be writers themselves, you know, seeing that I'm just an ordinary person. I'm just, you know, I loved writing books and, you know, writing stories and making stuff up as a kid, being in shows, doing drama, that kind of stuff, you know, using my imagination. They can now see that as a result of that, here I am published. It's a great feeling, absolutely wonderful. And I show off terribly every time a new book arrives, and I drive my family mad running around the house going, look, look, it's my new book.
No, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. You obviously touched on the team element of it. Obviously, Our Beautiful Game isn't an illustrated book, but obviously a lot of your children's books are. So as as we've said as well, and regular listeners know that I've got a little toddler myself, and you see the fantastic illustrations that are there. Yeah. I'm just kind of interested, what comes first between the chicken and egg? Is it a developing process?
Yeah. Well, it start off with a premise? I can't draw a stick person. So for me, what will happen is for my picture books that are illustrated, for instance, I work very often for Faber. I've got a series of picture books about a zebra called, the first one is called Not Yet Zebra, and the second one is called Calm Down Zebra, and they are illustrated by the wonderful Julia Wolf. So in that case, I will write the text, and then she goes away and does the illustrations, and then they come back together. And for me, that's the most gorgeous thing, because just seeing how someone else has envisaged your characters is amazing. But obviously in Our Beautiful Game there aren't any illustrations, so my job is to make sure that I draw the pictures with my words for the young reader, so that the 9, 10, 11 year old reading it can picture, because not only because it's a book about sport and a book about sort of lively action, I've got to make sure they can see all that in their heads, but also because it's a historical book, I'm trying to make sure that contemporary kids who've got no idea what life in the First World War, they've got no idea what life without a mobile phone is, yet alone life without electricity, you know. So I'm trying to make sure in some of the houses I'm writing about, you know, there wasn't yet electric light, there's gas light in the streets and things. I'm trying to make sure that I draw those pictures with my words, because I can't rely on an image. I have to entirely do that through my descriptive writing. And I'm trying to make sure that a kid reading it can slip back in time and lose themselves in a picture, a written picture, of life at the turn of the last century.
So you might be interested to know then, so I'm obviously early on in the book, so there won't be too many spoilers today. There's the playing football in sort of the back streets and the sort of the open areas. But in my head, I can't get away from picturing that alleyway in Coronation Street. And that's all I can see. I know that there's more people playing. It's a bigger area.
Yeah, it'd be very, very similar to that. Certainly that's kind of, you know, where kids be kicking a ball about. But I think also, you know, any kind of flat area was taken over. Same as now, you know. I mean, obviously now there are more purpose-built football pitches and local councils and communities make sure there are spaces, and there are things like basketball courts where people will go and play football, but it's the same. I mean, you know, and there are less cars, of course, for people to worry about. So, you know, any kind of flat space outside a pub, places like that, you know, that was big enough to get a game going, because there weren't sort of municipal purpose-built places for unofficial teams to go and play football, which is part of the problem when we get to, which I know we are going to get to, part of the problem of the FA ban is that there weren't then a great deal of places for people to play football, you know, to find a flat space, you know, to play football big enough to play a decent game with two sides is not an easy thing if there's no official area set aside to do that.
Yeah, so just a sort of full disclosure for the listeners, I'm only on chapter 10 at the moment, or at least I think it's chapter 10. So there's not going to be any massive spoilers. Our main character's just become a sister for the first time, to add to a little brood of brothers. So spoilers are going to be relatively minimal. But if you are dead against knowing anything, then maybe put this episode on pause and come back to it once you've completed the book. But yeah, so you should be okay and safe to kind of listen through. We're only going to be talking about sort of like the premise more than anything else. So this is probably a really good point to go on to the book. So could you tell us about the premises of the book, and in particular the book's main character?
Yeah, so the book is centered around a young girl who's sort of 11, 12 when we first meet her, called Polly Knab, who is desperate to play football. And it's set during the First World War, the 1914-18 war, which, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, was a massive time for women's football because the game really, really exploded. And Polly is desperate to be part of that. And she gets a job working in a munitions factory in a Lancashire town, which is actually very closely based on Preston, Lancashire, where the famous Dick Kerr ladies team came from. But I didn't want to actually write about the Dick Kerr team or famous players like Lily Parr and Alice Woods, although they really inspired Polly's character. But I wanted that freedom to bring in different elements of things that might not have actually happened to the genuine characters. And because it's a story about sort of female friendship in the shadow of war, you know, I wanted to have different things and different relationships. So I pulled hugely on everything I could possibly find out about all those young players, incredible young players like Lily Parr, like Alice Woods, who were playing at this time. But then I fictionalized them all into Polly Knab and her teammates so that I could have them have their own personal adventures. And because of that, I fictionalized a town as well, Kirsten, which actually I call the main town in my story is called Kirsten, which is a blend of Kerr from Dick Kerr's and the Stun from Preston. So I created this.
I like it.
Which, spoiler alert, maybe where Polly ends up playing for a big team, which is very closely based on the Dick Kerr ladies. But again, I didn't want to be so sort of hidebound by that particular history. Also, partly because I think Dick Kerr's was so phenomenally successful that in some ways it's not that dramatic because the rivalries that they had were perhaps not as sort of hard fought. So if
a bit one-sided.
A bit one-sided, exactly, which as we know isn't going to make a great drama. So actually, again, by fictionalizing the team and the players, I was able to make sure that some of the struggles were a bit more pressing, perhaps.
Yeah, but I've been really enjoying the world that you've been building and the picture you're painting of life during the Great War. So for anyone else, that's sort of 1914 to 1918. But early on, you talk about these games being played by sort of male factory workers. And you describe that normally teams were made up of unmarried men against married men.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, this was a detail that I picked up actually in a wonderful account that I read of the Dick Kerr ladies team. And it was just one detail that really stuck with me. And the author, who's Barbara Jacobs, she said something really interesting that she talked about how that's possibly one of the ways in which girls came to play more, because the unmarried teams began to get short of players as the young men went off to war and began to fight and not come back or not come back able to play mainstream football. They came short of players. And so Lily Parr in particular, I know, played on her brother's teams when they were short of unmarried men, because obviously some of the married teams often have much older men playing for them, and so they weren't as affected by the war. But it was just one of those, you know, this is one of the wonderful things about being an author and researching a historical period. You get a tiny detail like that, and it allows you. I mean, I've built a whole sort of a scene. There's a whole chapter really just based around that idea of who gets to play and who doesn't in a married and unmarried men's team, and who might be on the lookout to allow a girl to join in because suddenly they want the players. It was a really interesting insight, isn't it?
How easy was it to find out this sort of information? Were you able to speak to any historians or even former players?
Yeah, no, I didn't actually manage to, partly because of lockdown. But I was planning to go up and visit and spend a lot of time in Lancashire. And then I started to write this on the first day of the first lockdown was when I started to write this book. And so that obviously changed the way I approached it. But there's lots of fabulous material and some great books and some great studies, not only on football, really brilliant sort of memoirs of Dick Kerr's ladies team. In particular, there's a great book, and sorry, that's where I'm going to have to say no because I can't remember the name of it. Sorry. Ah, here we go. In particular, there's a great book, a League of Their Own by Gail Newsom, who she's really sort of researched all the players and the families and their background from the Dick Kerr's team. And that was fabulous. So I was able to get hold of lots of information. But also what I found actually was some great memoirs about working in the munitions factories as well, because all the time I'm bringing together these two stories. And I thought that it would be much older girls and women who would be working in the munitions factories. So I was thinking that wouldn't really work for my story. And then I stumbled across lots of proof that girls as young as 11 were working in the munitions factories, which is shocking. You think this isn't Victorian times, you know, this isn't even Edwardian times. This is, you know, this is 1914, 1915, 1916. But 11-year-old girls regularly worked in these incredibly dangerous factories where there were explosions, where people lost, you know, limbs and fingers and all sorts, you know, and the girls were very much part of that working community, which was something I hadn't realised I'd stumble across. So again, it's historical research is so wonderful. It's like unpicking threads, and you start to pull on one thread and all sorts of amazing things will come out on the end of that string. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And obviously we touched on Dick Kerr ladies who were based in Preston.
Yes.
They're obviously the most famous side of that era.
Yeah.
But what do you think, why do you think football is so special for the northwest of England?
Women's football, I think, is especially special, perhaps because it's such a strong rugby region, actually, strangely. So perhaps football was the less aggressive of the two games, perhaps. There's a thought there. But I also think it's a, you know, strong working class area, tradition of women going out and working in factories before things like the war, and before, you know, so many women came to work in munitions factories, which was one of the great spikes for the women's game. But I think women were already, you know, working class girls were tough, you know, and not expected to be dainty and shilly-shally about, you know. So I think it comes with a long tradition of girls getting on with it and girls being respected to look after themselves and be tough. But then I think the difference between the factories that they would have worked in before the war and the munitions factories is just actually that in the munitions factories, suddenly two things really important. It becomes the majority women. So suddenly the women are on their own, you know, and for many working class girls, it would be the first time that they're sharing their free time with other girls and women, because prior to that, lots of girls would have gone into service and worked at big houses as, you know, scullery maids, whatever. So you have your free time on your own and you don't get very much of it. Suddenly working in a munitions factory, there are not so many men around. You're working with other women and you're in a forecourt, you're in a courtyard with joint free time, like playtime at school. You're so break time at school, you're suddenly all together and you play. And so it's no surprise that football, and there were a few men around, and so football sort of started organically, and it started very often, I think, between competitions between the boys and the girls, the men and the women, and it kind of grew out of that. But crucially, it's the women are wearing trousers at the factory.
Yeah.
And if you've ever tried, girls, to play football and tuck your skirt into your knickers, it's not easy. You know, the minute you're actually wearing trousers, it's a stupid thing, and we're laughing, but it makes a massive difference. Just to kick a ball not wearing a skirt is a huge move forward, massive move forward. You can't really kick a ball in a skirt. It just can't be done.
Yeah, well, you just look at modern school now. You've still got girls that, while they have the option for trousers, they're still... Seems this often seem to be in skirts.
Well, lots of schools won't let them wear trousers, and then you've got the whole skirt debate. But of course, we're talking, you know, turn of the last century, we're talking ankle length skirts. We're not talking above the knee, you know, to try and kick, and with petticoats, you know, to try and kick a ball, if you've got something, you know, heavy, tweedy, thick, you know, the sort of fabrics that, again, that working class girls would have had, they're thick, they're hard wearing, they're heavy, they're down to your ankles. You're not kicking a ball in that. So the minute they get put in trousers, which was munitions work, you know, changed that, they started to wear overalls because it was safer to be amongst these very dangerous machines, you know. And it should have happened before that in the cotton mills and stuff, obviously, because they were also incredibly dangerous environments. But with munitions work, trousers come in, bingo, football's ripe to be played.
Do you think these wartime roles added or gave women confidence?
Absolutely.
And women and girls
absolutely
confidence to play?
Completely, definitely did, because they were doing their bit and it was seen as doing their bit and they were respected. And again, although these were areas where women had worked in factories and cotton mills and stuff, the pay was really good in munitions. I mean, it wasn't as good as the men. The men did the same job as the women and the men got paid more.
There's another episode.
It's a traditional story. We're not unfamiliar with this. But, you know, suddenly girls and women doing their bit, being paid a really decent wage, being respected for being part of the war effort. You know, and at the same time, this is the same era. You've got the suffragettes and the suffrage movement all going on simultaneously. All this is coming together and class is changing. And you know, and certainly post-war, all that tradition of the way Britain had been run was thrown up in the air after the First World War and was never the same again. And so incredibly exciting times for girls, for working class girls in particular, to re-envisage their lives in a different way. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, definitely. So in 1921, the FA obviously banned women from playing football league grounds, stating, I quote, "The game of football is quite unsuitable for females and ought not to be encouraged." What do you think were the main motivators for this ban?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? And I'm sure your listeners are familiar not only with the ban, but that no FA official was allowed to officiate at any women's match, because obviously women were allowed to play football, but we couldn't referee it, obviously, because we weren't capable of that. So we still, you know, it wasn't allowed for a female referee. So we had to rely on male refs, and the FA said at the same time that no officials, no linesmen, no, you know, so the whole overnight a stranglehold was put on the women's game. And we were talking earlier about the availability of pitches, and they were playing at these massive stadiums, you know, and filling grounds, and you know, people desperate to get in to watch the women's game, and overnight they're reduced to being back on a bit of waste ground behind the pub. You know, an extraordinary length that the FA went to, and I don't know how much, Stuart, you've read up on this, but you know, you get you know, Tottenham and Arsenal captains and coaches coming down, and to name two teams. I mean, many teams did this. The male teams coming down and putting in their opinion and saying, "Oh, yes, women wouldn't be able to have babies if they played football," and you know, that women's knees don't kick in the right direction. The FA got all these Harley Street doctors to come and say that women's knees didn't move in the right way to play football. And so you're right. You have to ask the question, why? What were they so afraid of? And to me, it definitely reeks of fear, because why else? And I think it was because, you know, the women's game, as I say, started quite organically in the First World War. It hadn't really been played. There's some history of some sort of Victorian women's football and sort of, you know, leading up. But the First World War was this absolute explosion, as I say, because of the life in the factories all coming together. And all of a sudden, you've got women's teams all over the country, and you've got these big matches. The 1920 Dick Kerr's Boxing Day match, 53,000 spectators in the ground and others shut out, unable to get in. And they raised, you know, which was the other thing, these matches were for charity. And so they raised, I think, over £3,000, which is about 145,000 quid in today's money. So that's one charity match. And this had all been great, and it was making money for the wounded troops, and everyone thought this was great. There was a bit of a laugh. The girls were showing their knees and you know, at the beginning of the war. And then I think by the time you get to 1920, the men are coming home, and the 1918-1919 season didn't happen because, as we know, the war famously ends on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. So that's November. So, yeah. You know, that season wasn't able to get going. So by the 1919-1920 season, the FA is really ready to be, you know, bringing the men's game in a huge way. But they see a threat from the women's game, and what had started as a bit of a joke and a little thing on the side and a way to earn some money for the boys at the front is suddenly a serious opposition. And certainly in that first season, some of the last season when the women are allowed to play post-war, that 1919-1920 season, women's games frequently outsold men's games. And so I think there was alarm, there was panic.
There's almost seems to be a correlation between the empowerment of women to the emasculation of the men.
Yeah.
So it is fear, really, isn't it?
And it seems such a shame to me, and so short-sighted. And I think, again, you know, we've got to put it in context of social history. Again, this is a time when the suffragettes, people are afraid of the suffragettes. They're afraid of women wanting votes. They're afraid of women wanting more. The men, you know, within the factories, there was lots of stuff. The trade unions put in place all sorts of levels to make sure that women couldn't work entirely alone in the factories, so that post-war they would always be able to say, the women didn't really do our jobs, they did a version of our jobs, you know, because there was this fear that the men would go off to fight and that the women would claim ground in all sorts of places, whether that's in factory work, whether that's in sport, whether that's in politics. And I think the FA ban is an example of that. It's you know, a male dominated, I mean, there were obviously no women on that FA committee in 1921. So a lot of men sat around in a room. And again, as we know, sort of historically, the FA was run by, you know, more sort of upper class men, perhaps, than the grassroots players. And they're sitting around wanting to keep people and wanting to keep women in their place. And I think it's absolutely founded on jealousy and the huge amounts of money that the women were making. Which was interesting as well, because that had been for wounded soldiers during the war. And then post-war, that begins to be towards striking workers and things who were striking for better pay. And so that becomes much more political. And it felt the sort of socialist agendas, which again is making the establishment nervous. But I think it was particularly that these were women playing football, filling stadiums, and they didn't like it. And I think that's why they closed it down. And it's shocking and terrible and has done untold damage. You know, we're talking 100 years, certainly talking 50 years, you know, where women didn't get to play. And imagine where the women's game would be if in those 50 years women had been allowed to continue to play at the level that they'd be playing. You know, and we'd be talking about, you know, now we get, and it's great that we celebrate. And she's really had a spotlight shone on her. Someone like Lily Parr recently, you know, has had a fantastic spotlight shone on her. But she would be one of hundreds of women who would have played across that period of history. But as it is, we're looking at her and going, wasn't she extraordinary? We shouldn't be doing that, really. It's a shame that we're having to do that. We should be saying she's one of, in the same way as we talk about the men's game, you know, we could pick 100 heroes from that 50-year period, but we've only got, you know, one or two great female players to look at from those early years of their game, because it was clamped down and shut off. Although women didn't stop playing, of course they didn't stop playing. They kept playing and they kept the spirit going and they kept the grassroots game going. Thank goodness, because that's what leads to us, you know, being able to be where we are today. And in 1971, when the ban was finally lifted, so 50 years, you know, almost to the day since it was put in 1921. Finally, it's lifted and the women's game was ready to, you know, there was still an ember burning, thank goodness. But it's shocking.
Yeah, definitely. And when you began the book, was it always a target of yours to release it this year, the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, it seemed to make sense. I sort of stumbled across the Lily Parr story. And the minute I read it, I thought, this is a kid's book, you know, because obviously that's the angle I come at things from. I'm a kid's writer. I'm always looking for stories about young people doing amazing things. And Lily Parr was really young when she was playing professionally. You know, she started playing at 12 and she was, you know, the scoring you know, hundreds of goals by the time she was 14, you know, very young player. And I thought, this is a story that kids are just going to love. It's a girl following her heart, following her passion, pushing through. But then as the story got bigger and I thought about it being this fight against the FA and the fight against people, men trying to close down what young girls want to do, I thought very much that this centenary of the ban was a really important time, partly as well because I didn't want it to be a negative thing, because obviously it is about closing and my story ends with the FA winning almost and saying to Polly, my fictional character, and her team saying the game's over. But actually the book, spoiler alert, but the book ends with you know, Polly saying, you can take our ball but you can never stop our game, you know, we will keep on playing, you can do what you like, guys, but you're actually not going to stop girls gathering together and playing football. It will happen. You can try and stop us, but you won't. So I wanted to make sure there was that sense of energy and that sense of the ball being passed to this next generation. So it was definitely seemed timely, and definitely because the story ends on a slightly sad note for Polly and her teammates, but we know that there's a kind of glorious ending with you know, the huge passion for grassroots girls football now, and fantastic, you know, international teams like the Lionesses, etc., etc. We know that the history, you know, didn't go against us, and that we managed to build this fantastic, joyous game that we now have.
Yeah, definitely. And sadly, some of that misogyny is still around at the moment. And for me, a lot of that was brought in by this ban and that thought that women aren't as good. And it's quite simply wrong. When you aren't given the tools at your disposal to flourish, then female footballers are obviously going to suffer. And we see a lot of this online with it takes the BBC to promote one female event and then you get all the naysayers coming on. Do you think that there'll be a point in our lifetime where women's football will be widely considered on par with the men's game?
Oh, gosh, I hope so, don't you? I mean, I think our kids' generation, you know, contemporary kids are so much better at not being bothered who's a boy, who's a girl, who plays what, who does what. I really hope that this will be the last of this nonsense. I really do. But you know, I think you can't expect the women's game to be in the same state as the men's game because it was under a stranglehold for 50 really crucial years. And so in 1971, it almost had to start again. You know, as I say, obviously that the flame was kept going at grassroots level, but it had to start again thinking about really sort of high profile. And I think it's only been in the last couple of decades, hasn't it, that women's football has been taken as seriously as it should be. And as you say, it's still not always taken as seriously as it should be. But then you look at something, you know, you look at equivalent sports, you look at something like women's tennis and men's tennis, there are still naysayers there. You know, I mean, it's just, but I genuinely believe that this generation of kids are much better at taking it for granted. And certainly, I think the really heartening thing is that if you go now and walk past any primary school playground in this country now, you will see as many boys as girls, as many girls as boys running up and down in their break time, kicking a ball about. That will just be a fact, you know, and it's not seemed odd or strange for a girl to be playing. And I think to build on that will be the incredible thing. And as you've said, Stuart, you know, there are so many girls teams playing in leagues, playing across the country, you know, with young girls, 11, 12, 9, 10, 11-year-old girls, you know, and they're seeing their heroes and they're seeing people. And there is more availability to watch games on television, all that sort of stuff. So it can only get better. But yeah, I think hopefully it's an end to the silliness, but I shouldn't think it's done and dusted, Stuart. I should think there will still be more, but hopefully we're moving in the right direction all the time.
Definitely. Wouldn't it be fantastic if a lot of these 10, 12, 13-year-olds managed to stay into the game, into their
adulthood? Oh, amazing. And I don't see why not now. I really don't see why not. You know, as long as there are funding paths and training opportunities made available for all young people, regardless of, you know, gender, skin tone, anything, you know, God, let's just open it up to everyone.
Do you have any plans for your next book at all?
Well, yeah, I'm already sort of in the foothills of my next book, which is another historical one. I'm going back a little bit in time. I'm going back to almost 100 years earlier. I go back to 1818, writing a book. So playing around with some ideas there, not about football, about something different. But it's amazing how, you know, 100 years further back, I know even less, and we know even less about how kind of society worked. And so I'm just at that early research stage, having fun, unpicking stuff and looking for leads to follow in a sort of detective-like way. So that's really great.
Yeah, it's always nice to see when someone enjoys their job.
Oh, I love it.
Nice to see your face. You're beaming about it.
Well, you know, I'm lucky to get up every day and make stuff up. I mean, you know, and I don't have a boss. You know, what's to complain about? It's perfect. And I get to talk to kids and readers and, you know, it's a joy, absolute joy.
No, definitely. Do you think that you could be tempted to go back and revisit this same subject matter, but maybe write something of a similar theme for even younger children?
About this subject matter, but actually I think the women's game is really, just as we've been talking, actually I've been thinking about, you know, actually how it would be good to do the highly illustrated picture books that we began talking about, actually to do a picture book for very young kids about certainly about boys and girls playing together, maybe would be just a really inspiring and positive thing to do. Maybe a, you know, team of a team of long-legged flamingos and storks and giraffes and, you know, all playing football together, boys and girls, all, you know.
Well, now you're bringing back memories of Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yes, exactly. But so that sort of idea, I think, would be great to do something about certainly showing positive images of girls playing football at a very young age for a really fun early picture book would be really fun, definitely. Something I'll have a think about.
Oh, fantastic. So if any of our listeners don't already own the book, how can they get their hands on a copy?
Well, it's called Our Beautiful Game by Luke Hunslet. That's me. It's available in all good bookshops, online, anywhere you want to search it. Ideally go to your local bookshop and ask them. They can always order it if they don't have it, because it's great to support a local bookshop. But if not, the usual online retailers will have copies of it. And it's great. And hopefully by, you know, a young girl reading this, or a young boy. I mean, because it's actually for everyone, because it covers the story of the boys off at war and the girls at home and all sorts of things. But hopefully, particularly, I suppose, for a girl who's keen on football, reading this and getting a sense of the legacy of those players that have passed the ball on to her would be, you know, I feel my job was done. That would be marvellous.
I think we're almost selling your book short a little bit by talking about it being suitable for a younger age group. I think that's your starting point, but I think it's suitable for anyone and everyone of any age.
I know adults and teens have really enjoyed it. I think you wouldn't, you know, I'd say anyone over the age of nine would really enjoy it. It's sort of, you know, it's aimed at your 9, 10, 11-year-old reader. But absolutely, I mean, there's dark stuff in it. There's stuff about life and football and friendship and feminism. And, you know, so absolutely, it's for anyone over 9 years old, I would say. And hopefully.
Yeah, well, within the first 100 pages, we've got a childbirth and the images of labour at that age.
This is the First World War in a cheek badge owl community. People are dying, people are being born, people are fighting, people are, you know, afraid, people are excited. It's an emotional moment in time, and hopefully I've captured something of that on and off the pitch in the book.
Well, you've done a superb job so far. I'm really enjoying it, genuinely. And hopefully I managed to find time in between looking after little ones, coaching football teams, writing websites, working my day job to actually get it finished. But it is a great one. And I would encourage everyone to go out and have a look and read it. And I think you'll enjoy it. I know once I finish mine, I'm going to be, as much as I want to keep the little copy, I think it needs to be shared. So I'm going to be sharing it with my aunt, who's a Portsmouth Football Club season ticket holder, and someone who I'm going to be bringing along to Portsmouth Women when that all restarts in August.
Fabulous. Brilliant. And then you can get it back when your own daughter's old enough to have a read. You can get your copy back and pass it on.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, thank you again for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing the TV show.
To the movie, exactly. Hollywood, here we go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Stuart. That was lovely. Thank you so much for taking the time.
And so for anyone that wants to follow your work, where can they find you online?
Well, you can. I've got a website, which is, if you Google Lou Kunzler, which is K-U-E-N-Z-L-E-R. So it's L-O-U-K-U-E-N-Z-L-E-R. You can find me. I'm on Twitter at Lou Kunzler. If you go onto the Faber website, they'll have information about me as they publish the book. But basically, a great way to start off, Google Lou Kunzler, or follow me at Lou Kunzler on Twitter.
Excellent. Well, thanks again. You take care. And yeah, hopefully we'll get a little bit of break in this hot weather.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.